several miles off the main highway, tucked away in a secluded canyon on prime vineyard property, stands a rustic barn that was built many decades before the vines around it were planted. In that barn, a sophisticated broadcast and recording studio has been built. The barn also has a well-hidden root cellar stocked with many of the world's most exceptional wines, only to be shared with guests who secretly come to offer their insights and tell their stories. Guests are sworn to secrecy and are shuttled to the studio aboard a John Deere tractor. Those who cannot make the journey in person are interviewed by satellite hookup, and sometimes the crew simply sneaks away with microphones in hand and interviews guests in barrel rooms, wine cellars, and other magical places. All of this is done like clockwork every single week, so that we can bring you another episode of Grape Encounters Radio.
Peel me a grape. Crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
And it is time for your weekly grape encounter. And you know what? Once in a while, we get to go on some pretty terrific adventures. Actually, who am I kidding? We go on great adventures every week. But boy, oh boy, have we got an adventure for you today. We are out in the town of San Miguel on the central coast of California, but we are on a property called Villa San Juliet, which is owned by the former executive producers of American Idol. I'm sitting in a Jeep right now, literally at the top of the property, and I'm getting a tour with Dan Smith, the wine director, winemaker here. And Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is cool. You driving around, a wine glass in one hand, a microphone in the other, steering with your knees.
Oh, that's not true. I don't have a wine glass.
That is absolutely not true. No, but we are out in the boonies, as one would say. And let's talk a little bit about what's going on here. We like to bring to our listeners, you know, adventures that wineries are undertaking to make the whole wine tasting experience, just really the whole wine lifestyle experience, more fun. And you guys have just unveiled this really cool program wherein we can get in the Jeep and tour the property. And so often we never get back into the vineyards because a lot of times they're a long ways away from the tasting room. So why don't you just give me a rundown now of, you know, what goes on this property. We're sitting on, first of all, how many acres here?
We have 108 planted acres on the property.
108 acres. Like, and how many bottles of wine will that make, Dan?
A lot.
A bunch, right?
Yeah, definitely. So we wanted to bring out an experience for the customers that was beyond the tasting room. We have this beautiful property. We're a vineyard and winery operation. And so to take out our guests around the vineyard paired with a tasting outside the vehicle was really important for us to be able to show everything that we're doing, the landscape, how we're farming our fruit, and the type of wines we hope to make out of
them. And this is some kind of ride we're in too, by the way. This is a Jeep, but this is not an ordinary Jeep. It's got like this gigantic sunroof.
Yeah,
is that a double sunroof? Is that what I'm seeing?
The whole top comes
off. Oh, wow. It's too windy today.
It's a little too windy today, a little chilly, but once the sun comes out more consistently and the weather warms up a bit, we'll pop that off, and so people will really get a outside excursion experience.
So what do two guys who are, you know, famous TV producers of one of the most popular shows of all time, what caused them to get into the wine business? I mean, that just seemed like such a strange thing to do, really.
Yeah, definitely. Well, they're childhood friends from Liverpool, England. They came to the U.S. to start the show American Idol. They were told, hey, keep your bags packed because this isn't going to last very long. Lo and behold, the show was a huge success. So they moved over here. They were filming shows in Las Vegas, went out to dinner, had a glass of wine. They wanted a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon. They didn't care from where, but they asked the server to bring out something that he thought was very good.
Because if you're from England, all wine is good.
All wine is good.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not a huge bar to set there. I'm just kidding.
Well, they've got good bubbly. That's the thing. In fact, I read the other day, get this, this is really an aside, but the Queen is now making bubbly. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yes,
that's amazing.
Yes, she's making bubbly. But going back to American Idol and this winery, so they're there and they order Cabernet Sauvignon, and then what happens?
Server brings out a bottle of Paso Robles Cabernet,
I
believe from Chateau Margine. They tasted it, absolutely fell in love with it, and had to know where it was from. They were certain it had to be from Napa. The server said, no, it's from Paso Robles, California. They were amazed, then started this this conversation of this childhood dream they had talked about a few times about starting their own vineyard. So they started to explore the area, decided on this location, and in 2005 they purchased the property, and now we're a full functioning vineyard and winery.
Right now we're sitting in the Jeep, and we got out of the Jeep and got to taste a little bit of your rosé, which was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Really fantastic. But what are we looking at here? I mean, I'm looking 360 degrees of Chateau Saint-Juliet.
We're actually one of the most northern vineyard sites in the Paso AVA, and then specifically we're located in the Estrella district. So we're one of the most northern vineyard sites. So up north is the border of the AVA. South is everything below us. So we have an excellent view of the whole AVA. It really shows. We're in the Estrella district specifically. We range from 950 feet and then incline to about 1100 feet.
Gotcha. So, and then you have planted here every single major Bordeaux varietal.
Yeah, we have all five major Bordeaux varieties planted, along with the Rhones, Grenache, Syrah, Petit Syrah. We also have Zinfandel, Alicante Boucher, and then we grow Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Gris.
Kind of interesting because this area is, I think, probably better known for the Rhone than for the Bordeaux. But as you get further up north, it seems like we see more of the Bordeaux varietals planted up here. What is the difference, just for people who are listening? And when we say Bordeaux, we're talking about Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Sauvignon Blanc, Petit Verdot, and Merlot and Malbec.
Yeah.
That was six. Anyway, that versus Rhones, which we see so much of, you know, here, which are the Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèd, and others. Is the difference in growing conditions the climate? Is it the soil? Is it both? You know, when do you decide to plant Rhone versus planting Bordeaux?
That's an excellent question.
I thought so, too. I did. I thought, God, because I've never asked that question, really.
Yeah.
That's about as technical as I get, by the way, right there. Yeah.
Well, we all know Zinfandel was first planted in Paso Robles widely. And I think some of the earlier pioneers started planting the Rhones, and those were very successful. But there's been a huge push and experimentation in growing these Bordeaux, and especially in the warmer climates, especially on the east side. As you know, J. Lohr's out here. They're doing excellent things with their Bordeaux. So I think for us, following suit from what's been successful, and then, you know, these vines were, a lot of them were planted in 2008, and now we're really seeing the effects of the quality and, you know.
But when you say, wow, this is going to be a great place to grow Bordeaux versus this is going to be a great place to grow Rhones, at what point do you as a winemaker, or I should say as a viticulturist, say this is what I'm going to plant? I know it's a lot more scientific than that, but just to dumb it down for a second.
Sure.
You know, what are the giveaways?
There's, as you know, tons of factors that go into the decision to plant.
You're not going to let me oversimplify.
I'm not going to let you oversimplify it.
You're not going to let me do this, are you?
No, because there's so many considerations to take into place.
All right. Let's just say this. Go to school, learn the science, and you'll figure it out. But you've got them all here, needless to say.
So. Yeah, we have 12 varieties. They all have their distinct characteristics. A lot of them have common fruit flavors. I think that's a soil influence. And so we're able to do some blending between the Rhone and Bordeaux. That's what we're trying to also become known for. We have two blends that are Rhone and Bordeaux based of different styles.
Okay, now here's
styles.
A question that I know I'm going to make you answer this question.
Okay.
You're not getting out of this.
Okay.
For a long time, we hardly blended any wines at all in the U.S. There were the Bordeaux blends, but after that, we were very selective about blending. And I'm saying going back, you know, 20 years ago, we were much more into single varietal wines and blending was almost taboo. Little by little, we began to blend, but the blending was mostly within the family. We didn't go outside the family. Now, in the last couple of years, there's this explosion of blending. Forget family lines. We're just going to blend anything that seems to work. Is it anything goes now? And in terms of being a winemaker, you know, how much more freedom do you think you have now versus if you were doing this 20 years ago?
I think the market is really receptive to blends at the moment. And so that for me as a winemaker is really exciting because there's not a lot of rules as far as, you know, being a new world country of what we're able to blend together. I think there's maybe a misconception that blends of different regions is lesser quality, but we've really found that it's probably the most hard thing to do, blending grapes that haven't traditionally been blended because there's no precedent for how
right,
that's supposed
exactly,
to taste.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more freedom, I think, artistically, stylistically with what you're trying to accomplish with, you know, flavor profiles. And yeah, it's just been really fun. It's more complicated than you would think.
Well, I know. And I was going to say that I think in the past 5 years, winemaking just became so much more fun, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Freedom. Can we play that song Freedom now?
Freedom. Freedom.
All right. right. So where are you taking us next?
So we are currently at the top between block 1 and 2. We're next to our Pinot Gris and Cab Sauv vines. We're going to drive through block 3 and 4, take a look at some of our new plantings of Cab Sauv on the right, and then we'll drive up and around the Sauvignon Blanc, which is our highest elevation point.
And if you just tuned in, we are at Villa San Juliet in San Miguel, California. They have started a new attraction. You know, there was a time when you went to a winery, you went into the tasting room, people were backed up, you know, 4 and 5 people deep to get tastes at the counter, and you got in there, you had your taste, and then you got out and you went on to the next winery. Now wineries want you to stay, spend the day. There's all kinds of things that they're doing to keep you on the property and enjoy all of the, you know, new attractions that they've built. And this is a great example of what wineries are doing now. It's a Jeep tour of one of the most beautiful properties that you can possibly imagine. Do I have to pay for this if I'm a customer?
We offer the tour $10 for a wine club and $15 for non-wine club. We really just want people to have a good experience. It's kind of a VIP exclusive look at the vineyard. And so,
are you expecting a big tip at the end of this?
I mean, I'm not going to say no if you slide that my way.
All right. We are going to take a little break here. We'll let the guys back at the studio patch in some commercials, and we're going to make our way to the next stop on our journey here at Villa San Juliet in beautiful, sunny Central Coast, California. And we'll be back in just a second with more Grape Encounters.
This segment of Grape Encounters is brought to you by my number one wine discovery of 2016, the awesome gold medal winning wines of the Cardello Winery. From the very first sip, you'll understand why these astounding, nicely priced Cardello wines are swiftly becoming a cult classic, just as I predicted. Handcrafted and stunning, you can get yours at CardelloWinery.com. That's CardelloWinery.com. Or find more information at GrapeEncounters.com.
This has got to be the worst remix I've ever heard.
Hey, this is definitely one of those days where I can say, I love my job, love my job. I mean, how often do you get escorted around a vineyard in a really, really classy Jeep by a really great winemaker? This winemaker, Dan Smith, at Villa San Juliet in San Miguel. This was a winery that was founded by the executive producers of American Idol. I guess they know winners when they see them. Now, when they come up to the property, do you ever have to sing and dance for them, or do they expect that from you?
Fortunately for their sanity, or my sanity, it's not a requirement.
Oh, okay, it's not a requirement.
Although I've been known to shake some
of it, so. You shake that booty. Let me ask you this. They also had another hit show, right? It was So You Think You Can Dance, right?
Yeah, that's Nigel's show.
Yeah.
And that's still on. I think they're coming up with their next season pretty shortly. So he's a judge and executive producer for the show.
So is there anything that you see that they bring to the table working in Hollywood and having hit shows? That's not easy stuff to do. Is there a certain quality that they bring to this property that you notice that really makes a difference?
Definitely. I think as creative people
types, yeah.
And you know, they're in the business of searching for talent. So I think they know how to piece people together and really let people and their expertises kind of roll with what needs to get done. So for me, there's a lot of freedom in the winemaking. Try to pass everything by them and make sure that everything's tasting according to their thinking is. But, you know, it's nice to have that freedom.
So when they like something that you've made, what do they say? How do they react?
Is this going to get a score?
It's all about the numbers, man.
No, I'm just kidding.
This better win an award, Dan.
Okay.
Now, that's pretty cool. And they come up fairly frequently, too, don't they?
Yeah, they're here about a couple times a month. Kind of unpredictable. You know, they're still working, and so it's kind of when their schedule allows. But they'll bring their families up and come out and hang out for a weekend.
Does that make you nervous? No, not at all.
No, their two families are really amazing. It does feel like you're part of what they're trying to achieve here. And, yeah, appreciate.
Pretty cool. Listen, so now we've traveled since during the commercial break. You took us quite a ways. is to the other end of the property. And now I don't know how far the view is from where we're at, but just to describe, we're way up on a hillside. In fact, I really don't like how steep it is in front of us. Have you got the brake set? Seriously.
Yeah, I've got the e-brake on, and then I'm just doing another check holding the brake down with my foot here. But
okay, good. Yeah.
This is definitely the most treacherous point of the tour.
We're not driving down that, are we?
We are. No. This is where the four-wheel drive comes in handy.
Holy smokes.
We'll wait maybe till I have both hands
for the
wheel.
We got to get a picture of this because you guys have got to see this. It is so steep. It goes straight down. And of course, you know, I have done the show zip lining. I have done the show rappelling down into caves. So this is nothing. Anyway, so what am I looking at then? I'm looking out to, is that west, that direction?
We are looking directly south. So
south?
Yeah, as one of the most northern vineyards in the AVA, this is just an excellent view of everything south. So you have the Santa Lucia is on the right here. You can kind of see the east side. Flatlands go out that way. And then, yes, San Luis is...
Yeah, he's pointing.
Right,
folks, I know you can't see
my hands.
I know,
but
Dan is pointing as if you can see which way his fingers are going. We didn't tell him this isn't television. He works with television people, you know, so that's what he's thinking. No, anyway, so that's south, that direction. And then, you know, this is some really, really steeply rolling property, much more so than I would think most vineyards, right?
Definitely. I think a lot of the east side is maybe perceived as flat, but the reality is that we have these amazing rolling hills. We're actually in the foothills of the Chelan Hills, which is kind of a northern extension of the Templar Range. So we definitely have elevation changes, not just kind of the west side, you know, that I think contributes to really nice fruit development and complexity on some of these east side.
So I asked you what the owners brought to the table, but I want to talk about you for a second because you spent a good portion of your career up in Oregon.
Yeah,
You know, wonderful, wonderful growing regions up there as well. And I just happen to love Oregon wines a lot. What do you bring from Oregon to California?
I was born and raised in Oregon, the Willamette Valley.
You were in the Willamette Valley.
Portland area is all basically the Willamette Valley.
So that was a more colorful way of saying that you're from Portland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, south of Portland.
All right, okay.
Yeah. So, but anyway, you know, just heavily influenced obviously by Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, Pinot Gris. And so the wines there are typically a little bit lower alcohol. They don't get as ripe as some of the varieties down here. And for me, it was more exciting to work with more diversity of fruit than just kind of one single grape variety. And so while I have so much respect for the wines up there, I think what I brought back from there was trying to push an elegance of restraint on some of these wines that, you know, the Paso, there's very big, massively extracted wines. And so I think bringing that influence into our white wines and then just trying to seek balance for the reds is my goal.
Okay, so tone it down a bit. A little more drifting toward the old world styles. Is that fair? No? Or just restraint?
Not necessarily. I don't have a set belief on... It's always changing per vintage. I'm still...
So that's an interesting point that you're making because so many winemakers try to make their wines as consistent as they can from vintage to vintage. But I happen to be a believer in, you know, let the wine speak. And if a vintage is totally different from the prior one, so be it. How do you feel about that?
I'm with you. For me, it's all about the growing conditions of the year. There's factors that are changing constantly. Weather patterns, as you know, we were in massive drought for the last 5 years. And so this is going to be our first year out of that desperate need for water. I think we got a lot of extraction, really nice fruit development from those vines struggling.
Right.
So it's going to be really interesting to see what this year brings with maybe a little bit more nitrogen in the vines. We'll have to kind of wait and find out.
A little too early to tell
right
now.
Yeah, a little too early right now.
All right, we're going to go to break, but I need to ask you about your dog, okay? Your dog is a carnivore for sure. You have a rescue dog. As much as I'm sure he appreciates you rescuing him, he's a little rough on squirrels. There, Dan.
Yeah, he's definitely a working dog. He's on the gopher and squirrel duty. He helps with the hawks and vultures. He does some of their dirty work. And then he actually gets taunted by the birds quite a lot.
Oh, because he's taking their food.
Well, he's not.
Does he leave it for them?
Yeah, he doesn't eat the
squirrels. Then they should be happy.
Yeah.
But anyway, he had a big smile on his face. I actually watched him go after a squirrel. In fact, that's where that term, I think, gopher came along. Go for it. He was proud. All right, we're going to be back in just a second. We are at Villa San Julia in San Miguel in the Paso Robles area of the central coast of California with Dan Smith, great winemaker and a great tour guide. We're taking the brand new Jeep Tour. How many miles on this thing, Dan? Like about 500 miles. That's
yep.
it.
Yep.
554 miles. Anyway, we're taking the Jeep Tour. You can do it too. And you can seek out all kinds of adventures like this if you go to wineries these days. So I really, really encourage you to do exactly that. This is a property, by the way, that you just have to visit. It's so extraordinary. really, really beautiful. Phyllis and Juliet, and we'll be back for a few more minutes right after this, so hang with us.
We know you do your level-headed best to catch every episode of Grape Encounters Radio. But in the event you've ever missed something and want to play catch-up, we keep every single episode archived online at grapeencounters.com. Not only can you listen online, you can also explore the remarkable ensemble of goodies we've put there just for you. It's not just a public service, it's how they raise enough dough to pay me. You know, I'm just saying.
We like to talk about wine.
In the immortal words of our host, David Wilson, show me a pretentious wine drinker, and I'll show you his new Tesla and the date he's hoping to impress. Welcome to the world's most down-to-earth wine show, Grape Encounters. Here's your host, David Wilson.
My back is sore, I've been out in the sun. When I get home tonight, I'm gonna have a little fun. Gonna let loose with my baby and unwind. I'm a wine country cowboy.
Okay, during the break, we drove back down to the winery and tasting room, and we are now on the veranda at Villa San Juliet, and my tour guide today, Dan Smith. He is winemaker extraordinaire and tour guide, works mostly on tips, as I understand it, right, Dan?
Yep, if they come my way.
If they come your way? Okay, well, I got a little something for you later on here. Anyway, we're back at the winery. What a beautiful place this is. I mean, from one end to the other, the property itself is so beautifully manicured to begin with. And then you come down to the tasting room and actually is like something out of Hollywood. And that makes sense since this is Hollywood owned, right?
Definitely. I think Ken and Nigel really wanted to build a place that they could share the good life with. So it's a place where people can come, kind of transport to wherever they feel is where they want to be.
Dan is pushing his dog away right now. The dog is in the interview. His name again is what?
Draco.
Draco.
Yep.
Draco, like Dracula.
Yep.
And we know why that is, too. We saw him in action. That was fantastic. Dogs and wineries just go together, don't they?
I think so. If anyone's having the time of their life, it's this dog here. So
I'm going to say this. If you go to a winery and they don't have a dog, just keep going. No, seriously. The dog at the winery is going to be a great indication of how good the wine is going to be. It's something that I've just noticed. It's a really, really cute, friendly dog that lets you, you know, just crawl all over him. That's going to be a good winery. I'm telling you. Okay. All right. So let's just kind of wrap it up as far as the tour is concerned. So people come here. Instead of going into the tasting room, then you take the wines along for the ride and take them to various stops around the property, right?
Yep. We bring four wines to enjoy along the tour. So we'll stop at a few designated stops, talk about where we are in the property and taste the wine, talk about the wine and really give that one-on-one.
You know what I think is so cool about that, Dan, is the idea that you can literally drive to the spot where the grapes came from, and it's gone down this long tour, and then you can go back, bring the bottle with you of the wine that was made from those exact grapes.
Exactly.
And sit there and look at the soil and the dirt and the plants and the dog eating the gophers and all of that, and just really become more connected with the wine itself.
Yeah, I think so often you go to a winery or a tasting room, and someone's telling you how the wine was made. With the tour, it allows us to show you how the wine's made. For me, I'm a learn by doing person. That's my Cal Poly in me. And so being able to show that practical side, really connect people to the vines. There's something spiritual there. And I think it's giving that emotional connection to the what they're drinking, I think is pretty powerful. So,
well, I think what also is very interesting is that you hear people in tasting rooms. And I have to say, it kind of is off-putting for me when you're in a tasting room and the person who is explaining the wine to the general public customer is getting into this great detail about soils and things. And, you know, so many of the people who are hearing this, they don't really, probably don't even want to hear that because it's not connecting with them. It's like, what is alluvial and, you know, what is limestone and what is, you know, chalky soil and some of the terms that are used. And it's kind of nice to be able to instead point down to the ground and say, this is the kind of soil that these particular grapes like. And you can pull a handful up in your hand and explain why that is.
Yeah, if you're not putting your hand into the dirt and looking for texture and observations of different changes between rocks and minerals, I don't think you're ever going to really fully understand what it's all about.
Yeah, exactly. So I think really it does give you a much better understanding of the whole process. So that I appreciate very much. There's a lot of stuff that goes on here at this winery, but just I wanted to talk for a minute about the wines. This is like a zoo when it comes to grapes, a grape zoo. You have so many. It's like Noah's Ark of grapes.
It really is. For the size of our property and then the 12 varieties we grow, there's certainly a lot to choose from as far as styles go. And so for us, it's trying to give attention to each of these varieties. We make a single varietal out of each of those wines.
So you really do?
Yeah, we do. And then usually they'll get a reserve, and then we have an estate program that we have in distribution, Cab Sauv, Petit Sirah, Sauve Blanc, and our Corum blend.
Tell listeners some of the varietals that you grow that they should seek out as a single varietal wine that they probably haven't had before.
Sure.
And maybe haven't even heard of. I can think of a few that you told me that you have here. But throw some varietals at listeners that you think would be interesting to them to try.
I think the Alicante Boucher is something that's different. Not a lot of people have had that wine before.
It's so nice to say, too.
But it is a very interesting flavor profile. Compared to other Vitis vinifera varieties, it's one of four that's actually a Tinturier grape. So it has red flesh in the berry to start with. So
that's the difference, is most grapes, even if it's a red grape, you cut it open, it's got sort of a clear
clear juice. A lot of the color comes from the skin extraction.
From the skin, but Alicante Boucher, not so. The meat starts red.
And you would think it might get a little darker with the skin contact, and it does slightly, but it's really the color you get at harvest is the color that wine's going
to
be.
And that's a grape that's most commonly used to rev up red wines to make them more concentrated looking and tasting, right?
Yeah, it's classically a blending grape, but we made the decision based on tasting some exceptional barrels from the 2010 vintage that was a single varietal that we wanted to bring into market.
Alicante Boucher. And remember, gentlemen, if you really want to impress your girl, you say to her, "Darling, you look so Alicante Boucher tonight." And she won't know what that means, but it means dark and fleshy.
Dark and fleshy.
Anyway.
On top of that, our Cab Franc is an excellent single varietal.
I always have to stop people at Cab Franc because I am lobbying for Cab Franc to be next year the varietal of the year. Okay, I think a lot of people are starting to plant it, more of it now.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And I think it's one of the absolute tastiest wines out there, and you need to discover it. And this is a good year to discover it because you're going to see a lot more Cab Francs in your wine shops than you've ever seen before. And don't be afraid of them, right?
Definitely.
I want to be frank with you.
These dad jokes are killing me.
Even the dog just covered his ears with his paws. Anyway, no, Cab Franc, that is the delish grape.
It really is. It's, you know, it's the parent of Cabernet Sauvignon, which, as you know, is a cross between Sauvignon Blanc and Cab Franc.
They had an illicit affair.
They
made the love child Cabernet Sauvignon.
Exactly. So I think it's definitely that noble variety that I hope gains a lot of recognition. It's, you know, it's popular in a lot of Bordeaux blends and a lot of blending in general.
The thing is, it was the big dog for years.
Oh, yeah.
No, it was the grape.
Yeah.
No, you didn't mess around with Franc.
Right. There's very distinct flavors in that. And it's a difficult wine to make. It's a difficult grape to grow. It has a tendency to capture a lot of pyrazines if you don't treat the canopy correctly.
Explain what pyrazines are.
Methoxypyrazine, that's the major aroma compound in green bell pepper. So you bite into a green bell pepper, that's distinct methoxypyrazine.
But I have to say, it also is an acquired taste because I happen to like that flavor.
Sure. And so,
not too much, but a little bit. I like
it. Yeah. The challenge ends up being how we mitigate the pyrazines enough that it delivers varietal typicity, but doesn't overpower the wine.
Okay. And we've got time for one more grape.
Oh, Petit Verdot. That's another one.
Yeah.
It's one of our favorites. It's not caught on as well as I'd say some of the other single varietals we go because it's not fruit forward.
I really went to bat 2 or 3 years ago for Petit Verdot and also Petit Sirah. They're not really related, distant relatives. But I really went to bat for Petit Verdot, especially because made right, I think it's one of the most interesting, delicious grapes. And it's just so, I love the word unctuous, you know, it's just chewy.
Right.
But I don't think that many people make it the way that I like it anyway. I was going to say they don't make it right, but who am I to say?
Mm-hmm.
They don't make it in a style that I really like. But sometimes when it's made in a softer, lighter style, it is just to die for.
Definitely. Our wines are restrained, but there's a lot of minerality there. If there's not fruit, there's a lot of wet stone character. We do a concrete fermentation for the Petit Verdot. It's usually about a 3-ton fermentation, so very small, super extracted. We age it for about 3 years because of how massive these tannins are.
Yeah.
We're just about to bottle the 2013, which is kind of amazing. That's the last thing we've had in barrel from that vintage. And it's not because we haven't had a need to bottle it. It's because it's such a massive wine that it really needed that time in barrel to really soften before we got it to bottle.
All right. Well, Dan Smith, that's it. We're done.
Awesome.
I wish I could stay and play with you all day because this is quite the little playground you have here.
Absolutely. And Draco's always needs someone to run around with.
He's got energy. But anyway, listen, a wonderful place to visit. I always tell people when they come to this part of the world that you definitely have to come to this very imaginative winery tasting room. It's just absolutely gorgeous and really comfortable. You can just spend the whole day here and have a wonderful, wonderful time.
Absolutely.
And, the Jeep tour just makes it all that much more interesting. So I do appreciate very much the tour.
Yeah, thanks for coming out.
Probably dozens of times, and this is the first time I've gotten out in the vineyards, and I see this place from a completely different perspective. I think that's a really great idea that you guys came up with.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. And folks, look for adventures at wineries. Most wineries are trying to come up with things to make it more interesting for you, so don't be afraid to ask, you know, what can I do there besides taste wine? You're going to find a lot of places may have some offerings that you didn't know. That is going to do it for this segment of Grape Encounters. We got Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine, coming up next right here on Grape Encounters Radio.
At Grape Encounters, we're all about sharing. That's why it would be a crying shame if you didn't join our Facebook group page. Just search for Grape Encounters Radio on Facebook. It's where we're constantly sharing the latest wine news and information while you're waiting for your next episode of Grape Encounters. David will be right back as soon as he's through unfriending anyone who doesn't love wine. Oh, I guess it's going to be a very short break. She's earthy, honest, and sipping each week as a service to you. From Sunset Magazine, it's Sarah Schneider. This is Sipping with Sarah on Grape Encounters Radio.
Where's the cork for the wine bottle? It must have been mislaid. And the red wine just can't be found. It can't be far away.
All right, back with Grape Encounters Radio, and Sarah Schneider is with me, the inimitable. That's such a hard word to say, Sarah. Why do you have to be inimitable? The inimitable Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine. It is one of the two top lifestyle magazines in America, but in my book, with Sarah Schneider there at the helm of the wine division, it's the best, the very best.
Thanks.
Hey, listen, we're going to talk about a wine that I think is so misunderstood. Yeah, we're going to call it a type of wine that I think people are really mixed up about and confused, and I'm not sure who to blame. We're going to try to get to the bottom of this right now, but I am talking about Riesling. So many people come into the Grape Encounters Emporium, and they express their preferences, the style of wine that they want, and I say, well, how about a glass of Riesling? They go, oh, no, I don't like sweet wines.
Right.
Why does that happen, Sarah? Who is responsible for this travesty?
You know what? I think I was there when the travesty happened.
You did it.
I did not do it, but I was a victim of it myself.
You were a victim of the Riesling travesty?
I was.
What happened?
You know what? I live in Northern California, and we used to make a ton of Riesling in Northern California. And, you know, it's a grape that has European origins. Germany is legendary for its Rieslings. And Alsace in France is a legendary Riesling producer, generally drier. German Rieslings can be from dry to sweet. But when we made them here, we tended to channel the German tradition and leave a lot of residual sugar, not ferment them dry. So they were quite sweet, but we didn't have these bracing levels of acidity that cold Germany gets in its wines. And so ours turned out to be sweet and flabby. There was no acidity to balance out the sugar levels.
I had a girlfriend who once described me that same way. Sweet and flabby.
There you go.
Well, yeah, yeah. But there is this idea that Riesling means sweet.
Right.
And it's so disturbing to me because there are so many different kinds of Rieslings out there. there.
There are.
It is a very diverse type of wine.
Yeah, to your point, to be serious about it, in the old world, Riesling is considered one of the noble white grapes. It is at the top, you know, and it just doesn't get the respect here because of those horrible versions. But there were people along the way that started making better and better Rieslings here, meaning more and more balanced. I'm thinking even in the early days of the biggest winery up in Washington State, Chateau Saint Michel, they started making hundreds of thousands of gallons of Riesling, or cases, I should say, of Riesling, and it was good.
Chateau Saint Michel is a great example of a great American wine that is making solid wines.
Yeah.
And they run the gambit there as well, right? You
sure.
You can get dry or sweet,
absolutely,
whatever you want there. That's a great winery. And not only do they make great wines in high volumes, they do it very inexpensively. Their wines are not expensive to buy.
They aren't, but they are always good value.
They're always
good
value. I've never had anything from them that I didn't think was great.
I agree.
I can recommend it, and I can also tell you it's available any place.
Yeah.
You can get it anywhere. Now, you poured something kind of interesting here. I never seen this.
So this is a producer in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, and it's a very cool region. And they,
do you mean cool in terms of
climate?
But is it cool? Is it a cool place to go?
It's also a very cool place to go.
Okay.
The Willamette Valley is diverse. There's a lot of local agriculture, as in cheeses and produce and hazelnut and fruit trees. But the wine has gotten astonishingly good.
Okay, so yeah. Willamette Valley and a lot of wine coming from there, right? It's a really big growing region now.
Well,
all right, so I just stuck my nose in this glass and I would swear from first sniff, I'd go, this is going to be a sweet wine. This wine's going to be super sweet.
It does smell that way, doesn't it?
It says dry Riesling and I'm confused already.
People are starting to put that descriptor dry on there because Riesling is thought to be sweet. So take a sip.
You have any sugar? No. All right, so that's super interesting. It's kind of like sometimes you'll see these like waters that have extracts in them, you know, lemon or whatever.
Right.
And you expect them to be sweet, but they're not.
And they're not.
It's kind of like that.
Okay. So what happened in the Riesling world is that people started making drier and drier Rieslings, or if they were making sweet Riesling, it was more balanced with acidity so that it was a better wine. But the problem is nobody knew what they were getting in a bottle. So a few years ago, the Riesling makers got together and they said, well, how can we clear up this confusion? Because we can't sell the wine. And some of them started studying and they came up with a scale, which was intended to show from dry to medium sweet to sweet, that people could actually put on their bottle and put an arrow where their wine was on that scale. So this particular producer, Anami, which is actually a very good producer of Pinot Noir, especially up there. Thomas Hausman is the owner winemaker, terrific winemaker. He's done both with this bottle. It says dry Riesling on the front, so that's going to clear up some confusion. But you look on the back, and there's the scale.
Ah, really? And it's really close to bone dry. What's really interesting about this wine, okay, first of all, I got to say this. This is really delicious.
It's a delicious wine.
Oh my
isn't
gosh,
it?
This yeah. is I've never had this. Don't know anything about it. Love the label, by the way, but it is delicious. You smell it, you think you're going to get something sweet. Here's the interesting anomaly. Ready? You taste it. At first, you think you're drinking something sweet, and then you realize you're not tasting any sugar at all. The fruit is so big and spectacular in this wine that it causes you to think sweet, even though it's not.
Even though it's not.
That is a feat.
Yeah, there's a ton of fruit and florals.
It's just
seems sweet.
I could drink this all day long.
From
this
green apple to peach.
I'm so glad you brought this. This is so good. This is so delicious. So how big a winery is this?
It's a fairly
substantial. What do they say?
Anami?
Anami.
Yeah.
Anami.
And I believe it has to do with two daughters of the original owners, Anne and Amy. But Anami sounds more like a wine
label. All right.
Label.
That is a gorgeous illustration of what Riesling is supposed to be. And a lot of people don't even consider this kind of possibility.
And I will have to add a plug for not this particular wine, but the whole family.
It'll cost you $20.
With the level of acidity and those fruit flavors make it such a good food wine, especially dry Riesling, is just fabulous across Asian dishes from Vietnamese to Thai to Chinese. The spicier they go, you might want a little more sweetness in your wine. But it also hits sushi and fish tacos, Riesling and fish tacos. You've got to try it.
I would never have thought of that.
Or even like a chili verde, a green chili pork dish.
Really?
Because Riesling has a big enough mouthfeel. It's got an oiliness about it that makes it really good with pork. And you put some green chili, in, fresh chilies in there, and it's really pretty fabulous.
You have got me convinced that Riesling could actually be a good food wine. All right, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. Hey, Sarah, why don't you take us out for a change? I'm always ending the show. You want to give it a shot?
That's going to do it for Sipping with Sarah and Grape Encounters for the day, and we'll see you next week.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.